Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery. I'm Ann Eller, and it's my great honor to have Congressman Tom Rice on the air with us here this morning. Tom Rice, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing well, Ann. How are you?
I'm good. But I'm telling you what, I think when the president tells us to quit watching the news and that he doesn't watch the news, we're in trouble.
I think you're exactly right. And unfortunately, it seems he learns about a lot of the crises that we face every day from the news. It's amazing how little he seems to be plugged in.
Well, you know, I guess we should just say maybe I can't decide, Tom. Is it his staff that keeps him in this bubble, or does he really want to be in this bubble?
You know, Ann, I got the impression, particularly at the Bergdahl situation, that it was almost like a manufactured scandal to keep us from talking about the prior scandal. I think the wheels are off. I think they're flailing around. We need to do a much better job of administration in the next 2 years. I hope that they're coming to that realization. I'm certain the American public is coming to that realization. I think back to when the president was debating McCain in the first election, and McCain says, "This guy's never done anything." He said, "All he's ever done is been a community organizer." And the president said, "Well, what's wrong with being a community organizer?" Well, now we understand that, you know, you have to have administrative skills to be able to handle that job well. And I think the president just lacks a little bit there.
Absolutely. I believe that you are correct on that point. But, you know, I was real interested to talk to you about the very fact that you were a tax attorney and a CPA for 30 years, and here we have this IRS situation. Lois Lerner, Chuck Grassley, the letter that she ended up with that was talking about him going to some function or something, and all of a sudden it's headed up to see about putting further scrutiny on Chuck Grassley. What do you think about what is happening there? You have to have some inside understanding, even better than those of us that are watching the news.
Well, I certainly don't believe the line that is being towed by the officials that have been appointed by the administration. It appears that they're, you know, hunkering down and doing whatever they can to protect themselves and the administration at the cost of the truth. And the American government can't function without the trust of the people. Certainly can't function well. And the IRS, which has so much power and so abrasive, they particularly have to have the trust of the people that they're being fair, and very clearly they aren't. And I'm certain that this is all going to be rooted out. I suspect at some point there will be a special counsel appointed. And I'm really kind of surprised it hadn't happened already. But this will all be rooted out, and the truth will eventually come out. Unfortunately, it's going to be painful in the meantime. I remember that, you know, I don't sit on government oversight. I wish it did in this circumstance. And so, therefore, I get very little opportunity to directly question these senior officials. But we did have, in my small business committee, we had the acting commissioner of the IRS come in and testify before us, a guy named Danny Werfel, fellow that was there before this new administrator is. And he was just in there for the interim after the scandal immediately broke, and the acting or the permanent commissioner at that time resigned. And Werfel was, I don't know how old he was, he looked like he was 30, seemed like a bright guy. But throughout the course of the questioning, before they got to me, it was obvious that he didn't know anything. You know, they had just put him in there, and that it appeared to me to be a very conniving strategy to appoint as their top appointed official and their spokesman somebody who could very, you know, clearly answer, "Well, I just don't know." And that's pretty much what he did the whole time. So when it got to me, the first question I asked was, how long have you been at the IRS? And he said, about 6 weeks. And I said, well, what did you do before that? And he said, I worked for the Department of Health and Human Services as a environmental engineer or quality engineer. And I said, well, how many people work for you? He said, 43, but I got promoted just before I left, and there were about 100 people that worked for me. I said, well, how many people work for you at the IRS? And he said, 78,000.
Wow.
So very clearly, his entire appointment was not intended to, you know, tackle the real issues facing the IRS. He was not qualified to do it, nor was it intended to shore up public support and trust and try to solve the problem. He was put in there as a fall guy, somebody who could literally say, I don't know. I don't know the answer. And I told him that. And I told him that I hoped he was a good manager because his immediate predecessor had resigned, and they'd had two of their top officials plead the fifth to avoid criminal prosecution, and that he had inherited a huge mess, and they were getting ready to inherit administration of Obamacare, our health care system. And I truly fear for that as well. You know, when you see the VA scandal and the very clear example of how the government can never deliver services with the same efficiency that the private sector can. With this huge scandal at the VA and a perfect example of how the government can and will deliver health care, and here we are headed with the government sticking itself further and further and further into our entire national health care system. It truly is a very scary time.
It is, and you know, like you said, the trust factor on this. But you know, one of the things that I think about is, you know, sometimes something gets so big that there is no way to it develops a life of its own. It almost seems like the federal government is at that point, Tom.
Well, it is. And I think, without strong checks, that's the natural progression of things. I think bureaucracies feed on themselves. They make themselves, their own selves, important. And that's why you have to have good, strong elected officials to hold that back. And that's why we desperately need the Senate to put these things in check. And hopefully to God, we'll get the presidency next time. And I don't think the debate on Obamacare is over yet. And I think Dodd-Frank has the potential to be as bad, if not worse, on our banking system, and therefore on our businesses, small and large, and therefore on our employment, and therefore on our economy. I think those two things were huge expansions of federal power and federal control over our banking system and our health care, and they will ripple throughout our economy for decades to come if we don't rein them in. And we've got to take the Senate, and we've got to take the presidency.
Well, we still have though 2 years, don't we, till we can even get to a new president. We have 4 or 5 months to see what's going to happen in the Senate. But that actually leads into one of my next questions, Tom. You know, here we are, it's the 4th of July next week, and then we'll have campaigning going on, and then, of course, it'll be November, the elections. Are we really looking at anything happening in the federal government between now and January of next year?
Well, I think that John Boehner is taking, we saw the Supreme Court step up yesterday to rein in somewhat the president's actions, and I think John Boehner has picked up our idea about the stop resolution and using the court system to establish the proper relationship between the legislative branch and the executive branch once again. I think that that's a perfectly legitimate role of the court system. I think it's a perfectly legitimate question for the legislative branch to ask. I pushed it really hard and starting in December, as you know, and I think the House leadership has now picked up on that idea, and I'm excited about it. I think that it could affect American, the relationship between the president and the Congress forever. I think this could be a sea change, and it's needed because the executive has expanded and expanded and expanded its power, and part of that is Congress's fault because they've ceded so much power to the executive. But it's got to be reined in, and we've got to return to what our Constitution says. And you know, it's kind of comparable, if you think about it, to a city council and a mayor, and or a county council and a chairman, or those types of things, where you have to decide if you want a strong executive or a weak executive. And our founders wanted a weak executive. You know, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, and you know, our initial presidents all complained that they had so little power. But over the years, as things have evolved, and as Congress has ceded power to the executive, most recently with the earmarks, Congress has had less and less power, and the executive has had more and more, and federal bureaucracy has grown. And we have to return to the framework that our framers set up, and we're going to need the help of the legislative branch to get there. So I'm excited about John Boehner picking up this idea. I don't think it's going to be called the stop resolution, which is the one I did, but I think it's going to be the same framework, and we'll see where it goes.
You know, Tom, that was one of the things when Trey Gowdy and several others put together another, and I can't remember what it was, but they put that in place rather than your STOP Act. I never really understood why they did that, because it seems to me that the STOP Act is cleaner and quicker and more decisive.
Well, the reason that the STOP Act works where the Enforce Act, which is what what they did with Trey, the reason that the STOP Act works and the Enforce Act can't is because the Enforce Act requires approval of the Senate and signature by the president,
right,
which means it will never happen. In the current environment, it will never happen. You know, the House passes bill after bill after bill after bill to try to help the economy, to help families, to create jobs, and so on and so forth, rein in federal bureaucracy. But 10% of them, if that, are ever taken up by the Senate. Harry Reid is running interference for the president. Harry Reid is a very clear hypocrite. And so what we've got to do, the House has got to take action, and we, with the help of legal scholars, developed this theory that the House as an institution could bring an action for vote nullification, that the president, you know, under Article 2, Section 3, is required to faithfully execute the laws, and that he cannot pick and choose which laws he wants to enforce. He's got to do all of them. And, you know, certainly there's some limited discretion, but when the president decides that he's going to apply a tax or not apply a tax in a given year, as he's done with the employer mandate, when the president decides that he's going to decide who he's going to apply the tax to, certainly there is no justification for that. Certainly he's way beyond his authority. Certainly he's violating his oath under the Constitution, and he needs to be held accountable. And I think the court system is a very proper way to do that, and I'm excited about the prospect that leadership has come to that conclusion. That clearly a majority of the Republicans in Congress agree, because I have 120 co-sponsors on the STOP resolution, which does exactly that.
I know. But that's what I'm saying. I never could understand why they didn't just go for the STOP Act, and the Enforce Act that had to go to the Senate. It just didn't seem like a good idea at all.
Well, sometimes I guess ideas have a little time to take root, and I think that's happened now.
Okay. Well, that's great. Now, also, I know that you're rather excited about the Georgetown port.
I couldn't understand what you said. I'm sorry.
I understand you're pretty excited about Georgetown port.
Oh, I am. Yes, ma'am. In the Transportation Infrastructure Committee, worked hard to include in our latest ports improvement bill called the WERDA bill, a provision that allowed small ports to have greater access to what they call the Harbor Maintenance Trust Fund. You know what the problem with federal trust funds are?
What?
Well, you can't trust them and they're not funded.
But other than that,
they're fine.
Good one, Tom.
So anyway, ports like Georgetown now have greater access to that fund, and now we have to go make our case to the, that word of bill passed last month. It passed the Senate and has been signed into law by the president, and now we have to go make our case to the Army Corps of Engineers that Georgetown is a good, viable expenditure that will create economic growth and jobs. And we have the numbers to back that up. And also, the state of South Carolina is willing to put up far in excess of half the money. So the federal government share will be very reasonable. And I'm currently setting up a meeting with the Army Corps and other officials in Congress to talk about how we can get that done, and very optimistic about the possibilities.
Well, that's
and also there was, you know, one thing that we did in the Word of Bill that I think has been overlooked is the scariest thing I've heard in Congress is the process that the Port Everglades, the port at Miami, has had to go through to get environmental approval to be dredged. And you got to keep in mind that this is a port that's been dredged over and over and over again, and that we've got to get to 50 feet of depth to be able to take these post-Panama Canal ships. And if we don't do that, then if we can take those ships, the cost of transportation will drop by 25% or $700 per container. So if we can't take those ships, our importers and exporters and manufacturers in the Southeast will start out $750 per container behind the rest of the world, and that we already overtax and overregulate everybody here in the United States so much that we're barely competitive, and we can't be adding on to that. So anyway, I've been fighting as hard as I can to reduce federal oversight of these dredging. You know, certainly we need to protect the environment, but it's got to be reasonable. There's got to be a balance there. So what we got put in the Word of Bill was a provision that said that historically, once the Army Corps of Engineers clears you through all the environmental hurdles, then you have to go back to Congress to be authorized before you can dredge. And we took that step out, and that's a huge change in federal administrative policy. What we put in the Word of Bill was that once you received your permit from the Army Corps of Engineers, that the state or the local authority can proceed with their own money, and then when the next Word of Bill is done, come back and ask for federal reimbursement. They're not guaranteed federal reimbursement, but they can proceed and ask for it. And the state of South Carolina has already set aside the money to dredge the Charleston port. They're just waiting for the federal permit, which should happen next year. And this could very well speed up the process of dredging Charleston by a year or two. And I'm extremely proud that we were able to accomplish that in the Water Resources Bill. And that's one example where you see this Congress tearing back on federal regulation.
Well, that sure is good to hear, and it sure is good that you worked on that part and that you all got that through. But, you know, talking about EPA and regulations and everything, what is happening on the XL pipeline? Anything?
Well, the Congress, the House passed a bill yesterday that would take the president out of the loop on these pipelines. It wouldn't require a presidential permit. But the way the law stands right now, it requires any pipeline that goes across the country requires presidential approval. And the fact is that the administration does not want us on fossil fuels. They won't say that. They don't go out and attack, but they don't do anything to help the utilization of our own natural resources. I believe that if we went all in to simply use the resources that we have, that the situation in Iraq wouldn't be quite as disturbing as it is, with Iraq being such a major oil producer, that the price of fuel would be down because there would be more supply of oil. I believe that American families would be, you know, have more money in their pockets. You know, when the president came in and he wanted to do a stimulus plan, remember?
Right, I remember that.
And he did the payroll tax holiday, which saved the average working man $90 a month. Mm-hmm. And hey, I'm all for reducing taxes. And you got to keep in mind that two thirds of the economy is based on consumer spending. So when consumers have more money in their pocket, the economy does better. Now, by making every new well jump through all these hurdles by holding up the Keystone Pipeline, which would simply provide more supply, by not allowing even testing off our shores to see what is out there, and dragging our feet as much as we can, we're artificially holding up the price of energy. And that takes money out of consumers' pockets. Their utility bills, the war on coal, the utility bills go up $40 or $50 a month, according to CBO. Their prices at the pump, you know, when the president took office, the price of gas was $1.75 a gallon. And if you don't believe me, go look it up. And today it's $3.50. We will reach energy independence by the end of this decade. This country will have energy independence. But the question is, will it be at $2 a gallon, or will it be at $5 a gallon? And if the president's policies are continued, you can expect to see the price of fuel continue to go up. But if we actually went and we did what we could to encourage responsible development of our own energy resources, the price will drop. And when you take money out of consumers' pockets, well, what does that do? That, because two-thirds of the economy is based on consumer spending, you deflate the economy. And that means that all these young people coming out of college, because we told them, go get a good education, and they're coming out of college, and there's nothing for them, because our economy's down. It dropped 2.9% in the last quarter.
I was just going to bring that up, yep.
And that affects jobs. And, you know, I've got three sons, and I've seen what they've had to go through. And I am nothing concerns me more. Nothing bothers me more or worries me more than the fact that our children and our grandchildren will not have the same quality of life, the same opportunities that we've had. That it nothing bothers me more to have the president stand up in every speech and say he's for the middle class, but then to see how his policies cost the middle class money out of their pocket, cost the economy, and cost the middle class jobs. It is, he says one thing and he does exactly the opposite. And that just that truly does bother me.
Oh, it bothers me too. I tell you what else bothers me, Tom, is the fact that we had people before all this debacle that had good businesses, good incomes, and the economy. They were contributing, they had a plan, and now so many people's lives have been turned upside down with what has happened with
the
economy.
That's true. And I'm not going to put the entire debacle on Barack Obama, because George Bush obviously was in office when the financial meltdown happened.
Sure.
But I will say that we should have had a snapback by now. And the fact that 6 years after the recession hit or was over, that we have a negative 2.9% growth in the last quarter, that we've had below average growth the entire time, is evidence that this expansion of the federal government, that you will never grow the economy by growing the government like we did with Obamacare and Dodd-Frank. You will never solve the problems of poverty with entitlements, and you will never grow the economy by growing government. It simply does not work.
Well, it's been a social experiment that we can look to and see exactly what has happened.
And we are running headlong towards socialism, and I'm fighting it every single day.
Well, Tom Rice, I really appreciate you coming on and talking to us. I think you've done a tremendous job in your first year up there, and keep up the good work. And we'll look forward to talking to you again. Thanks so much for calling us, Congressman Tom Rice. By the way, are you at the beach?
I'm actually in my congressional office, and I have appointments all morning, and then we're doing a couple of appearances this afternoon.
Well, I certainly hope you get the opportunity to go out and enjoy the beach with your family.
Well, we sure will. And look, it's always an honor to be on your show. And call anytime you'd like to talk to us. Thank you, Ann.
All right. Thank you, Congressman Tom Rice. Bye-bye.